I would like to elaborate a little bit more on what I was talking about this morning, this matter of your emotional life. And I'd like to refer us to a few spots in the Word here. A couple of days ago, I referred to the works of the flesh. Let me review that again. The works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery. I think everybody would agree with that. And fornication. Everybody would agree with that. But now it becomes a little bit more controversial. Uncleanness and lust and idolatry and witchcraft and hatred and variance and emulations and wrath and strife and seditions and heresy and envyings and murders and drunkenness and revelings. When you look at that list, there are some of the things that we pick out that in our Christian culture, evangelical circles, we all agree are terrible. But some of them, and we'd even throw them out of the organization if they did it, and we'd throw them out of the church if they did it. But some of these things, like hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, it's quite all right to practice these, and you wouldn't be thrown out for these. And yet here they are, all in the same list. Now, on the other side, the works of the Spirit are love, and joy, and peace, and long-suffering, and gentleness, and goodness, and faith, and meekness, and temperance. The one kind of emotional reaction to life versus this other kind of emotional reaction to life. And if I understand Paul here, it's the fruit of God's Spirit that will enable us to live together peacefully. Now, I think that's a wonderful, wonderful, hopeful message. That says to me that I'm not a victim of what you do to me. And that says to me that the way I react to you is not a function of what you do, but what I am and how I am related to God. And so you put two people into the same village and one of them cracks up and one of them blossoms out. And according to this, if it's your emotional reaction to the situation, then this is a matter of your relationship to God that makes the difference. Colossians 3. If you be risen with Christ, then seek those things which are above, and set your affection on things that are above. And in a fifth verse he says this: mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, covetousness, which is idolatry, for which things sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience, in the which you also walked some time when you lived in them. And now also put off all of these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communications out of your mouth. Lie not one to another. See, this is the negative side of it. And then there's the other side of it again. And put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercy, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another, and forgiving one another if any man have a quarrel against any. You see, our ministry is a ministry of the Spirit. It's a matter of attitude. It's a matter of inner responses one to another. People who will be able to solve their problems are chapter 1, Paul says this, beginning with the 9th verse. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in judgment, that you may approve things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ, unto the glory and praise of God. Your ability to come together and look at a problem, having all your intelligence available to you, depends upon the spirit in which you sit down and do it. Now, I have a couple of pamphlets here that I want to share with you, written by a psychiatrist, Dr. O. Spurgeon English, who is chairman of the Department of Psychiatry of Temple University. And he's talking here about the psychosomatic concept of medicine. Nowadays, in your medical schools, the students are told that you can expect 50% at least of the people who come into your office to have psychosomatic problems. In other words, a combination of physiological difficulty and emotional difficulty. And he speaks of the autonomic nervous system, and he points out that the autonomic nervous system ties the whole body together, your muscular system, your blood vessels, the glands, the nerve endings of your body, and that these are affected by the way you feel, as well as by physiological factors. And so here he speaks of some of the stomach problems that are involved, that are involving the autonomic nervous system. And I'd like to share with you a few of the things he says. I'm quoting, "For decades it has been known that a personality problem which cannot be solved by the mind itself is prone to be turned over and taken up by some other part of the body. Now, when an irritating friend or a troublesome family member cannot be coped with," you ever have that happen? "The patient becomes sick. He can't stomach it. It gripes him. Now, the physician knows that the cause of these gastrointestinal disturbances is emotional conflict. He knows that it is the conflict of attitudes of generosity and responsibility struggling with an opposing wish to escape them." You ever have that experience? Here you are. You're supposed to be generous and kind and magnanimous, and you don't want to be. You've got your partner to live with, and there are things about your partner you don't like, and you've pointed it out, or you don't want to point it out because your partner thinks you're a real nice, sweet, easygoing soul, and you wanted to keep on thinking so. It isn't true, but you wanted to think so. Or you're a real nice fella, real easygoing soul, and there's something your wife's doing that you don't like, and it's griping you, but you don't want to let her know. And so you see these people walking into doctor's offices, and all they've got is an ache. I've talked to lots of doctors, and many of them make referrals to me, because it's not entirely a medical problem. Let me illustrate how this works. I think of a young mother. When she called up, she was a model, she said. Everybody in the office, even Reverend Thompson, picked up their ears right away. I had a model for a client. And the day came when she came into the office. Everybody peeked their heads out the door to get a peek at her. And sure enough, she was a beauty. And my secretary called me up and said, "The model's on her way down to your office. And I was all ready, too. And in she came. Oh, what a gorgeous creature she was. Beautiful flaming red hair. Wasn't her color, but it was pretty. She had the nicest complexion you ever saw. It wasn't hers. Oh, but it was pretty. And she smelled so nice. And she knew how to conduct herself, and she filled the room with her presence, and she was the gayest soul you ever saw. And she really knew how to give and take in conversation. But you know something? Sooner or later, I have to ask the inevitable question. What's the matter? And underneath this exterior was a very bitter woman. Now, for instance, here's this lovely young lady. Lives in a lovely home. One day she looked at her husband and turned on all her charm and said, "Honey, you know the faucet in the kitchen's dripping. Would you fix it, please?" She was so sweet and nice. And to her amazement, he didn't. And she asked him again and again, and he didn't fix it. And she got pretty mad. Inside. Didn't let it show. She still smelled nice. She still looked nice. She still talked nice. But she was getting pretty irritated with this guy. He can manicure the lawn. He can scrub his car. But he hasn't got time to fix my faucet. She said we'd sit down in a living room at night, put the baby to bed, and things get quiet, and what do I hear? Drip. 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 And the longer I listen to that faucet drip, the madder I get. Yeah, here's a person with a stomachache. She just can't stomach this guy. And they've got a modern house, you know, where you don't open doors this way anymore. You slide them back and forth, and one of these rollers broke. And do you think he'd fix that roller? And every time she goes to that closet, she's got to struggle with his door, and he won't fix it. He don't care nothing about me. Yeah, but she's got her front. So he comes in, he's got his troubles, too. Now, she sure has them, hasn't she, though? So he says, "Oh, look, I'm getting sick and tired of her griping about me. I asked her to, when she's ironing my shirts, to put my collar stays in the shirt. My mother used to do it. But do you think she'll do it? No, sir. And I get up in the morning and I put on a shirt and no collar stays in the shirt. Burns me up. And then I get down to the breakfast table, and I say to my wife, "Honey, I'd like you to put my vitamin pill in a plate. Wouldn't you do that, please?" "No, sir." "She won't." And he comes down in the morning, and he sits down at his plate, and no vitamin pill in his plate. You know, life's pretty tough, isn't it? Now, here are two people who are gradually forcing themselves apart. And what are we talking about? We're talking about wrath and malice and bitterness and stubbornness, aren't we? Oh, yes, it's all wrapped up in a lovely home, stereophonic music. They toss and turn on one of the finest mattresses money can buy. They pace the floor on one of the most expensive carpets there is. They drive their troubles around in a Cadillac. Aren't they lucky? But you see, the thing is going on inside of them. And so here we have this situation that the psychiatrist describes. He knows that the cause of these gastrointestinal disturbances is emotional conflict. It is the conflict of attitudes of generosity and responsibility, struggling with an opposing wish to escape them. I know I ought to do this, but I won't. I'm going to get even. If I give in this time, he's going to expect me to give in some more. And I'm not going to be forever giving in. think of another person. He got married. They got married on the basis that he was a real efficient go-getter, you know. When he said, "I'll see you at 8 o'clock," he was there at 8 o'clock. He wasn't there at 7:59. He wasn't there at 8:01. He was there at 8 o'clock. And he knew exactly where they were going to go. And he comes wheeling in there at 8 o'clock, and she is never ready. Never. And he'd kind of chafe and grumble, but pretty soon she comes down the stairs, and she was so pretty, and he forgot all about his grumbling and complaining because there she was. And occasionally he'd bring it up as they were driving along and say, "Honey, are you going to be late like this after we get married?" And so she says, "Why, wouldn't you love me if I was?" Well, when she put it that way, she says, "Sure, honey, I'd love you no matter what you did." Oh, how nice that sounds in the moonlight when you're not married. Oh, how nice that sounds when a couple of partners are talking about their jungle assignment sitting here. Oh, everything's going to be lovely. Sure, we'll work things out, won't we? Well, of course we'll work things out. Then they got married. And what they said was, "We balance each other. You see, he's a real go-getter, and so she kind of slows him down. And she needs a little encouragement, and she likes him because he gives it to her," so they get married. And the first thing he found out, he woke up. A lot of things you don't find out till you're married. Or till you get out into your jungle with your partner. And there she was laying in bed. You know, he never knew that women snored. That was an angle he was amazed how terrible she looked there. So he'd lay awake, and he'd fuss, and he'd stew. And he goes staggering into the bathroom, and what does she do? She squeezes a toothpaste tube in the middle. That's enough to blow anybody up, isn't it? Oh, you know, we can say such nice things about the love of God and about kindness and gentleness and patience and the amazing little things that expose you. Yet you'll say, who wouldn't be mad if a fella had to forever be looking at a toothpaste tube like that? And, you know, he'd set the alarm, and he wasn't sleeping well because he was griped about her snoring, and he'd dive out of bed and get all dressed, and it, where was she? Remember our pokey, easy-going, slow soul? She was in bed. "Aren't you going to make me breakfast?" "Oh, can't you get something down at the corner?" And you know, this became annoying pokiness to him, this balancing that he thought. And the more he pushed her, the more she bucked. And you know, it wasn't very long, and things weren't so good. But what are we talking about here? Here is a woman who simply brought out of that man what was in him. And here was a man who simply brought out of that woman what was in him. And if we move out to your jungle, and here you two girls are out there in this little hut, that partner of yours will bring out of you what's in you. And you'll soon find out how pliable you are. And how spiritual you are. Now, I'd like to point out to you the kinds of emotions that this psychiatrist says he has to deal with. When people come with these psychosomatic complaints, and here they are, listen. Hatred, resentment, rage, frustration, ambition, selfishness, envy, jealousy, sorrow, love need, fear. What are we talking about? What are we talking about? The works of the flesh. And how do you deal with the works of the flesh? The You know, if your major difficulty is simply the works of the flesh, then I say hallelujah, praise God, because the solution is reasonably simple. Or is it? What it amounts to is to take upon yourself your own sin. And this is no longer now a matter of trying to change that person that's exposing you, but this is simply a matter of turning to God with an empty hand. And day by day, He will help you to be what you ought to be if you want to be what He wants you to be. Now, I have been relating everything that I have been saying to this fundamental proposition that thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart and soul and mind, and it's God you want to please. And God says your ministry is a ministry of the Spirit, doesn't He? And now, as I have tried to show you the relationship between what you say and what you do and what you feel, and I'm going to drop this line because there's some other things we ought to talk about, but we need to include what you think and your goals and objectives in life, it seems to me that it becomes reasonable to say that to judge a man is not an easy matter, because there aren't very many people who've got enough facts about this person to really know what goes on within that person. But I am trying to say that God has given us a basis for judging ourselves. And so He says, take the mote out of your own eye take the beam out of your own eye before you're going to try to take the mote out of your brother's eye. And so Jesus said, if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. Now, some of you have come up to me and said, you know, you've sure stepped on my toes this week. And now I would like to say this. I hope that you aren't just satisfied to have your toes stepped on and then just go on as you were. Or to put it another way, as James put it in James 1, beginning with the 22nd verse, where he says, be ye doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own self. Oh, the pity of the Christian who is giving himself week by week by week. He's a hearer of the word. But then he does as is described here. If any man be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass, and he beholdeth himself and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he is. Now, you know the answer. If you will confess your sin, admit it. No excuses, no alibis, can't blame anybody else. This is the way I am. And I say this is not easy. This is not an ordinary thing that the Christians do that come to see me in my office. But if you will admit what you're like, which implies, of course, that you want God to help you, and that might mean, there's some implications here, that might mean that in your little hut, it might mean that you're going to have to ask the Lord to give you a real joy to live with this dominating partner of yours. Now, are you sure you want that? And you will confess your sin. He is faithful and just to forgive you your sin and to cleanse you from all unrighteousness. I believe, as I've observed people and in my own life too, that this is a thing you do once. It's like deciding to go to New York. That's a decision you make once, but between here and New York, there are all kinds of places where you can get turned off. And starting out for New York is one thing, and making all of the decisions that you're going to have to make to get there is another. And there will be many, 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 many more decisions for you to make, and yieldings, and coming to the Lord day by day as you go along. I want to give you an illustration of this out of my own life. I was talking along these lines at a family relations conference one time in Kansas City. And unexpectedly, my next stop was Wheaton. And unexpectedly, I had a day in between. And so I got on an airplane that night, and I flew all night long, and I was telling them how husbands and wives should live in harmony and peace and unity and like-mindedness, and what the spirit of a husband ought to be, and how important it is for a man to spend enough time with his family. And so here I was being a dutiful husband. I was going, way, I flew right over Wheaton, went to Flint so that I could spend that spare day with my family. And I got there about 8:30 in the morning, just as my wife was leaving. She didn't know I was coming home. She had her day all planned. Well, I could understand that. She said she couldn't possibly get home before noon, and so she took the car and left. Well, I had things to do downtown, so I took the other car and I went downtown. I got home first. I went down in the basement and I was puttering around, and I heard the car drive in the driveway. I know she knew I was there because my car was there. I fully expected her to come down in the basement and tell me how glad she was that I was home. What'd she do? She went up in the kitchen. So I dropped a few things and rattled a few things to make sure she knew I was down there. Patiently. I insist that I was doing it patiently. I was trying to tell myself this. What I'm trying to point out is that I didn't like it that she didn't come down there, but I couldn't admit it to myself. And I waited and I waited, and finally I gave up and I went upstairs and said hello, and she said hello. She wasn't very enthusiastic about it. And I thought to myself, what's the matter with her? And I'm still patient. And she fixed a little lunch, and we had one of these nice, quiet lunches. And I kept saying to myself, I wonder what's the matter with her. And I went into the living room after we were through, and I fully expected my wife to come into the living room and sit down beside me. What'd she do? She starts up her sewing machine. And I'm sitting there sputtering away. And finally, I got tired of this, and I said, it doesn't seem to me that you even realize that I'm home. What do you suppose she says? I ain't like a woman. Well, it doesn't seem to me that you realize that I'm home. I come home, and you don't even come up to say hello to me. Now, how do you like that? Well, I got home first. How come you didn't come down and say hello to me? Well, you're the one that came home. You know, it began to dawn on us. This wasn't exactly a lovey-dovey kind of a conversation. And I had to come to the... I finally woke up, I think, like the prodigal son who came to himself and said, what am I doing down here? I'd better get back where I belong. And I had to... And my wife and I, we came to ourselves. And we knelt at that couch, and I prayed for myself. And she prayed for herself. And we were reconciled. Continue along this line of thought that I started this morning, I have been making the emphasis so far on the importance of what you say and what you do, and I started talking about what you do and the quality of what you do. And I was trying to point out the fact that irrespective of what anybody else thinks about what you do, that you're the one that has to live with yourself. Now, I gave you the illustration of my young friend in his cigar. A fellow who thought that he could get away with something because nobody would see it. And he got caught. And there are many, many people today who walk around under a kind of suspense and tension for fear that they're going to get caught doing something that they don't want anybody to know that they're doing, but they don't want to give it up either. Now, it might be that something like this has ever happened at your house, where you have one of these kind of a kind of evening, you know, and the doorbell rings, and you wipe the frown off your face, and your wife wipes the frown off hers, and on the way to the door, you warn the kids, and you go to the door, and by the time you get there, here are some of your friends, and you open the door, and you say, well, hello, glad to see you, and your wife comes up, and she's all smiles, and oh, you're so glad to see these people, and you have a real nice, chummy evening together, and you just hope against hope that the kids will keep their mouths shut. And then pretty soon it's time for you to say goodbye, and you're standing at the door, you got your arm around your wife, and you're waving goodbye, goodbye, come again. And on the way to the car, these people probably say, now there's a happy couple. Why can't we get along like that? But then you can close the door and pick up right where you left off. And do you know, I'll tell you, there's lots of people that I talk to who are very, very troubled because of what they know about themselves, and nobody else knows anything about it. But there is a sense in which when you're alone and you review the day and you review the type of thing that you've done today, there is a quality to what you do that God expects. He expects you to serve Him, doing it as unto Him, doing it heartily with thanksgiving in your heart. Now, whether you do a task with thanksgiving in your heart or whether you do it heartily hasn't got anything to do with the nature of the task, but has to do with your relationship to God and your willingness to look to Him for your supply of joy for the task. As I said, there's many people who wouldn't get caught looking happy on a job, but you're afraid you might get saddled with it and that you wouldn't want to keep it. And I suggested that there are other reasons for talking about whether or not you should keep this job rather than, and one of the worst reasons for changing a job is because you're miserable. And so I usually, in working with a family or working with two people, and by the way, let me say this, that it seems to me that two single people living together in the same house really have fundamentally the same challenge before them as a husband and a wife. Now, a husband and a wife have to arrive at a way of life that is mutually binding and mutually satisfactory to both of them, don't they? And so do any other two people who have to work together or live together. So I trust that those of you who are single aren't just excluding yourselves, saying that what I have to say doesn't apply to you. Now I have a quotation here from Dr. Tozer that I'd like to share with you. I think he, in his words, is saying the same thing that these two Bible verses have said. We must offer all of our acts to God and believe that He accepts them, and then hold firmly to that position and keep insisting that every act of every hour of every day and night be included. Let us practice the fine art of making every work a priestly ministration. And let us believe that God is in all our simple deeds, and let us learn to find Him there. Now, I find in counseling with, well, I was going to say professional Christians, I didn't mean that, Christians who are in full-time service, that so many of them are likely to feel that I decided way back there somewhere to choose God's will for my life. And that's the last time I ever had to consider that. In other words, I picked my profession. And now I've settled the matter of God's will forever. And I'd like to challenge that. I've talked to many a person who is a missionary, who is a lazy missionary. And I don't think it's enough to be a missionary. Being a lazy missionary is not God's will. I've counseled with many a miserable missionary. And I don't believe being a miserable missionary is God's will. And so God expects us today to choose to do what we do as unto Him, and to do it heartily, and to do it thankfully, and to do it well. So it's every act of every day that we need to consider. Now here is another viewpoint. Philippians 4:9, which to me is something for each of us to weigh very carefully. Those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, Paul says, do. Now that's quite a challenge, isn't it? In other words, he's saying, as Jesus said, follow me, watch me. That if you do what I do, well, I should read the rest of the verse. And the peace of God shall be with you. Now we might say to people, don't look at me, look at him. But they're going to look at you anyway. You're the model. You're the one who came out there you're the one that said that Christ died for you and he is your strength. And so your maids and your houseboys and your neighbors, they pay attention, I'm sure, to what goes on around you. I've had many missionaries say to me who have had difficulty on their compounds, you don't understand what it's like to live on a compound. You've never had to live day in and day out and work with the people and have recreation with the same people and have a social life with the same people. You know, how can you know what this is like? And yet, right next door to them, there's a compound of nationals. And we want to tell them that they're supposed to live in peace and harmony in their little circle. So they want to see how you do it. And you're not going to feel wholesome. And you're not going to have a real sense of peace and well-being when there are areas of your life that have to be kept dark and that must be hidden from observation You would be embarrassed if people could witness some of the things that happen in your life. Then you're not walking the way you should. And you're a candidate for something better from God than what you now have. And I think it is important that you are able to say, and I am able to say to anybody, and people ask me this, believe me, when I talk to people about family relations, and I hope I'll get to that this week, you know one of the first questions is, how do you get along with your family? And my family, we get invited out lots of times to people's houses. You know why? They want to find out what we're like. I remember one time we were driving off somewhere to a dinner, and Beth said, Dad, do I have to act like a psychologist kid again today? And I said, you'd better. Sure, the poor kid is a psychologist kid. And so many people want to see what these psychologist kids are like. You get up and talk about family relations. Let's see how it turns out. I dare say some of you have thought of that. I wonder what his family's like. I wonder what it's like living with him. And people ask that of you, too. I wonder what it's like living with that missionary, walking with that missionary, riding along the highway with that missionary. Those things that you have both seen and learned and received and heard in me, do, Paul said. You know, at first glance, that struck me as a mighty egotistical statement. Imagine having the gall to say that. But the more I think about it, the more I realize that whether we'll like it or not, people are going to observe you, and your own estimate of yourself is going to be in terms of what you know about yourself. Well, Galatians 6:9 tells us this about the quality of what we do. Let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. And I think of this passage in Luke 6:35, where Jesus said, and what a standard. He said this, love your enemies and do good and lend, hoping for nothing again. And your reward shall be great, and ye shall be the children of the highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. And it's this kind of a spirit that God will give you and me, if we want it. Now let's go back through that verse again. I'm interested in the part that says at this point, do good, why? Hoping for nothing. Why are you to do good? Because you love him. If the only reason is because you want him to respond that way to you, then you're doing it for a wrong reason. You're being utterly selfish. The Lord says to us, I want you to do good. And I don't want you to worry about the result. Whether they respond to you or not is beside the point. You're not doing good for the fun of it. You're not doing good so that people treat you nice. I want you to do good because you love me. And you know, if you can really accept this as a goal for your life and pray that God will give you the strength to live this way, believe me, it gives you an independence, a freedom that is worth more. Well, as he said, your reward shall be great. I think Jesus put it another way in in the 5th chapter of Matthew. You see, I'm talking about what you do, the quality of what you do. In the 5th chapter of Matthew, he said, I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, and pray for them which hate you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be my children. Now, you know, when you can respond positively to a fellow who's patting you on the back, and you can respond positively toward a fellow who is cursing you, that's a pretty fortunate situation to be in, because then you are independent of what happens to you. And you are content. And you're looking to God for His joy and His peace and His comfort. You're not looking to fortunate circumstances for your peace and comfort. I believe this is the kind of relationship that God expects of us toward the world around us. Well, I'll pause here and see if I have stimulated some questions that you'd like to fire at me based on anything I've said so far. Are there any? There's a... Could you beller it out? How far would you say is too far? Well, I don't think when it says love your enemy, it seems to me that it's talking about your attitude toward your enemy. Isn't it? What you do is one thing, and how you feel about your enemy is quite something else. When you hate your enemy, that doesn't hurt him. That hurts you. He isn't even there. So this is a matter of a hard attitude toward people who take a position against you, is what we're talking about there. And I think that's very clear what our heart attitude ought to be. Now, it isn't a matter of turning on love toward your enemy. I'm sure none of you have been successful in doing that. It's only as you look to the Lord to give you this spirit. It's His spirit, not yours. But I think the point is that most of us don't even want to love our enemies. We're not supposed to. Many people would feel guilty if we did love those who opposed us. There was a hand over here.
Yesterday you made a statement that people that say they love someone but hate their sin are fooling themselves, that you can't divide between a man and his sin, or can't separate a man from his sin. That doesn't sound right. Would you like to clarify that statement?
Because well, I said the other way around didn't sound right. I find that, when you take separate a man from what he does, what have you got left?
Seek for his good. I mean, the Lord hates sin, doesn't he?
Well, if you can separate it, fine. But I find that most people who make a statement like that are not really reacting something short of love toward that person. So if you can separate the two in your own life and in your own mind, why, fine.
You can hate the thing that a person does. I mean, there are things that we don't approve in the abstract. I mean, things that people do that we recognize as being wrong, and yet we can still be concerned for that person that they might be brought to the Lord.
Well, when we have some of these negative emotions, hate and wrath and anger and some of these, even in psychological experiments, you'll find people's pulse rate going up. You'll find their blood pressure going up. Their respiration rate going up. They'll start becoming, even a psychologist would recognize